Hello again. This is Talking Pictures coming to you via Zoom. I'm Mary Stack.
And I'm Michael Dow.
And as usual, we're going to bring you a fusion of visual options that you can add to your possible viewing considerations for the coming week. And we're going to cover some films, some notable TV series, Netflix output, and perhaps other streaming options, which you may have discovered. I certainly have. Well,
yeah, this is much more of one of our grab bag kind of episodes, which is nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, first of all, let me start off talking about two movies I'm going to look at on Netflix. The first is a new version of Emma, which went onto Netflix almost immediately because of the COVID outbreak. And this is a very strangely cast film, a directorial debut by a person called Autumn de Wilde, which sounds promising. So this Jane Austen classic has been done so many times and so well in the past, it seemed like a very odd choice for a remake. But anyway, it has been done, and I was duped into going to watch it. I actually saw it in the movies. Because Bill Nighy and Miranda Hart were in the cast, and they're two of my favourite British comic actors. So, but this pair, even these two, can't redeem this ploddy production. It's a Regency-era comedy. It's a Jane Austen book, well-known book. Emma Woodhouse is a kind of rich busybody who likes to matchmake people. And she's played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who got lots
who?
Of...
I have no idea who that is. Could you tell me? Is
she? I'm just about to tell you.
Okay, I'll be quiet. I'm sorry.
All right, sorry. So Emma is a Regency era comedy, and it's a story of a rich busybody matchmaker, Emma Woodhouse, who's played by Anya Taylor-Joy. And she got a lot of press recently when she played Amy in Little Women. But she is terribly miscast in this role. She is meant to be this well-liked, well-intentioned person who kind of catastrophically interferes in love affairs, but means well. This casting is a wooden, unlikable creature, and one is hard-pressed to believe that the lovely, noble Mr. Knightley, who's played by Johnny Flynn very beautifully and poignantly, would ever tolerate this cruel, selfish, I was going to say cow, cruel, selfish woman for a potential mate. So with that, the dialogue is stilted. I was not transported to a place of delight, which I normally am with Austen productions. If you really want to see a first-rate production of Austen's Emma, then go back to Gwyneth Paltrow's brilliant portrayal of the lead, which won her an award for the role of Best Comic Actress. Emma is congenial, charming, she's well-intentioned, but believably gauche in the ways of love. And her performance is quite stunning, one of her best. And the rest of the cast are all pretty exemplary too. There's Toni Collette, Alan Cumming, Ewan McGregor, and Jeremy Northam. Directed by Douglas McGrath, this version is a little priceless gem, and you will leave with a smile of satisfaction at a job well done. So watch that and pass on the newer one. Okay, now for something completely different. Michael is going to talk to us about Planet of the Humans, which you know something about, right?
Yeah, there are still humans, right? That's probably a too soon joke, but whatever. Sorry, that's an incredibly morbid thing to say. Nonetheless, so there was this documentary, surprise documentary, posted on YouTube this week. It's called Planet of the Humans. And what it does, it's a documentary that's put together by a man named Jeff Gibbs, who I wasn't familiar with him beforehand, but his writing is actually quite good and in-depth. He's an environmental journalist and researcher. And he set about in this project to investigate the, which is called the dark side of green energy. And you approach it, and I approached it being very skeptical. I consider myself, you know, blatantly liberal. But I nonetheless wanted to hear the argument, because what he does basically, the film is effectively broken down into two parts. The first part focuses on the various forms of green technology and science that we're all readily familiar with these days, like wind power, solar power, that kind of stuff. And he goes through each example pretty much systematically, and he talks about why we've in effect been sold what is referred to in the film as the green illusion, meaning that solar energy, for example, is inefficient. The technology is woefully obsolescent. It has a very short lifespan. And perhaps most importantly, it is largely funded by Koch Industries. So there's that issue. And he goes through in detail about the environmental impact, not only of, let's say, solar panel gardens or whatever you want to call them, but also windmill farms, how that technology is likewise inefficient and obsolescent. So that's basically the first half of the documentary. And it
Michael,
leads you,
who funded this, and what do you know about this guy? Because this sounds a bit bogus to me, all this.
It's honestly not. I mean, it's the kind of film I would recommend or advocate that people watch on their own and come to their own conclusions.
What's this guy's background?
I don't know specifically what his background is beyond, I mean, you can look him up and basically Google him and see what he's written. The film is produced or executive produced by Michael Moore. And so I would say as an aside there, because you and I have talked about Michael Moore before and how his movies just get worse and worse with every film. They become increasingly strident.
Exactly.
But what's good about this is Michael Moore kind of funds it, but then clearly takes a backseat. There's no obvious presence at all. It's entirely Jeff Gibbs' film. And he goes, again, person to person, interviews all these people and goes to these sites. And he takes you through the sites. There's one specific example of, I believe it's a windmill farm that they're trying to build in Vermont. And the amount of devastation to the land. He captures this. He just shows it to you. It's painfully obvious. It's almost like he doesn't have to even comment on it. And he takes you through these sites and shows you how much of a negative impact the so-called kind of progressive technology and progressive investment really has on the landscape. So he kind of, he dismantles those. He also talks about electric cars and other examples, again, that are widely well known and recognized. But what's especially fascinating, what I'd really recommend it for, is that he spends a lot of time on biomass energy. And I have to ask you, you might be more enlightened on this than I am. Are you familiar with biomass energy?
I've heard of it.
Okay. What it basically requires is the use of natural sources to produce energy. And Exactly. And it ranges widely from the use of trees, shaving trees down to wood chips and then burning wood chips, to the use of garbage. And the film even implies that animals may be used as a rendering source for new energy. So what really struck me hard was the way in which biomass is becoming the new so-called liberating energy source. But at the same time, it's in some respects the most damaging and the most devastating.
Who's using this though, the third world? It's not one of the alternative methods in this country.
Right, that's why I say it's largely up and coming now. But the big issue now that they're facing is rapidly increasing deforestation. And for that matter, and what's really upsetting, to be honest with you, is the way in which fossil fuels, natural gas and such, that we still rely on that infrastructure in order to produce the technology required for biomass production.
This is a very convoluted argument, Mike.
Yeah, this is why I say, I mean, as I say, I won't go too deep into the weeds in terms of the argument, but it is to say that I was, number one, fairly convinced by the argument. And secondly, I would obviously recommend person to person that people check it out and really look into the extent to which we might be led down a kind of illusionistic path as far as progressive energy is concerned. Check it out for yourself. I mean, again, I'm not proselytizing this film. But it is remarkable the extent to which big business is entering into the picture, taking over, co-opting so-called environmental heroes like Bill McKibben or Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The main message ultimately, and I think why it's such an interesting, let's say, text to take a look at these days, is that we're all right now in the midst of a situation where we have no choice. We have to fundamentally alter our own personal behaviors, right? And our lifestyle. And the ultimate message of the film is, I think that we can't rely on the kind of green God, as it were, that, you know, technology is going to save us, so much as we need to fundamentally alter our own behaviors, and that it does ultimately come down to the people changing. A kind of an entirely different kind of sociological perspective needs to change, pertaining to consumerism. And never mind the fact that if, you know, you look at these reports nowadays and how the earth is healing itself already in such a short period of time amongst this pandemic. It's just, it's a curious counter argument. The reason, as I say, why I would recommend it, it's a curious counter argument that I haven't really seen or heard anyone methodically make, aside from, let's say, alt-right sources.
I've heard the right to make those arguments repeatedly.
So I would simply say, watch it with an open mind, listen to Richard Attenborough's counterpoint with an open
David
mind.
David Attenborough.
Are we actually recording this, or are we like having a mutual dream? This is so strange. So recommended from my perspective, you know, having, you know, listened to your point with a certain degree of reservation, but I think it's something worth, it's a viewpoint worth considering.
Okay, I take your point. I would say research the guy that made the film and who funded it. I mean, even if Michael Moore is, I like him, but he's definitely launched on some of his logic, you know, I mean.
Oh yeah. So yeah, I agree.
I would say watch Climate Change as well, David Attenborough, his last film for the planet, he says. So our last hope. And it's quite staggering, the facts in that. Okay, now completely different little indie drama, Uncorked, which I think was quite nice. I caught on Netflix this week. Written and directed by Prentice Penny, or I've never heard of. It's refreshing, it's a small budget film, it's powerful, predominantly black cast members. It centers around the life of Elijah, the lead, played by Mamoudou Athi. He's a young man born into a family who runs a thriving barbecue business, and they want him, or expect him, to take over the business, but he wants to become a master sommelier, and nobody in his house even drinks wine. So his hard-working father, Louis, played by Courtney B. Vance, who's excellent, expects him to take over. So there's this constant tension struggle between Elijah trying to do the right thing and also pursue his dreams. And it's palpable, the energy between these two. And they clash. And they're both very strong men. Fortunately, the mother in the plot, who is Niecy Nash, playing the role of Sylvia, supports Elijah and even gives him the money to go to Paris to actually study wine. While he's in France, she has a resurgence of the cancer that she's had, and he comes home for her funeral. So now everything fast forwards very quickly. Elijah has to withdraw from his classes. He's torn between his love for the family and his desire to pursue his career. But the reason why I liked it a lot is all the characters are pretty convincing. It doesn't go into a cliched ending. In fact, I was left wanting more. I would like to have watched more of it. I guess my biggest complaint was it has this terribly intrusive rapping soundtrack with F-bombs and N-words, and that is kind of dropped in at strange intervals and doesn't gel at all with the narrative. So it's a kind of a disconnect. Otherwise, I thought, well worth a view.
Is that juxtaposition, do you think that juxtaposition is on purpose to be jarring, or is it just a bad style choice?
I think it's bad style. I don't think it's jarring enough. The characters are, you know, contentious, and the actual plot is not very linear. It's interesting, but that was just, it felt like somebody was trying to make this a very kind of urban statement, and it didn't need it. It was really genuinely good without that. So
not enough restraint.
Not enough restraint, no. So down to you, down to Earth from the orbital. Now you're going.
Nice segue. We're getting pretty crafty at this. So, well, I was thinking, I was wondering, you know, what kind of movie would I want to recommend, again, given our current situation and compromised way of life. And curiously enough, I stumbled upon a movie that I had meant to watch 10 years ago and never got around to it. It's called Moon, a fictional science fiction film directed by Duncan Jones, who is David Bowie's son.
Oh.
Yeah. And so you can't help but watch it and think, Major Tom. You know, space oddity. Because the film, it's almost like he's playing a little bit off that. Not that he's, you know, resting on his, you know, ancestral laurels or anything, but whatever. So the movie stars Sam Rockwell, and he really is the only... I'm in love with Sam Rockwell. I'm not ashamed to admit it. And he gets better with every movie. But this was really, or at least it should have been, his breakout role. He plays an astronaut who is stationed on the moon alone, and he's basically running an operation in which they are, and it's a curious theme with my previous example, basically this business, Lunar Industries, is strip mining the moon as an energy source. And so he's there basically to maintain operations on a 3-year mission. And to be quite honest with you, I'm not trying to be coy, but if I gave anything more away than that, it would greatly, you know, spoil the movie. Because it gets twistier and twistier and stranger and weirder. Sam Rockwell begins to have these nightmares, and then he begins to hallucinate, begins to have visitations with himself. It's one of these movies where, you know, reality becomes increasingly ambiguous as this man's psychology is beginning to fragment. So I recommend it largely. It's not a comfort movie. I'm not going to say that. It's actually... You know, it's rather quite somber. There are moments of humor and levity in it, and Sam Rockwell's performance is very enlivened, and he's highly enjoyable. And he carries the movie, needless to say. But beyond that, I would just recommend it in terms of it being a great study in isolation. And I think people will watch it, at least allegorically, as, you know, a way of coming to terms with what we're all going through, you know, as we have to quarantine. Couple other things to say about it as well, and I know we've said this before when we've talked about science fiction. It's another movie that borrows so heavily from 2001. I'm beginning to I'm beginning to think I need to write that book, you know, In the Shadow of 2001 and How It Changed Sci-Fi Forever. There may already be a book out there. I'm not familiar with it. Another quick reason why it's so similar to 2001 is that Sam Rockwell's only accompaniment on the moon is artificial intelligence through the guise of a computer, not HAL from 2001, but this time the computer's name is Gertie, and he's voiced by Kevin Spacey, which even triggered me a little bit, so I can imagine it might trigger a few people, but yeah. he doesn't ruin it for you by any means. And the other interesting thing about the film is that if people are looking for such things, kind of deep diving analysis, it has a curious kind of Marxist trajectory to it, because Sam Rockwell's character kind of gets in touch with himself, comes to terms with his reality, and then further comes to realize, in a kind of revolutionary form of enlightenment, comes to realize that he's being grossly exploited by the corporation he's working for. So it's one of those kinds of stories. It has a wonderfully finely tuned political undercurrent, but you don't have to look for it to enjoy the movie, but it's highly enriching because you really, and when I notice things like that, I love seeing it because I recognize, okay, these are filmmakers who really know what they're doing. And especially when you're working in science fiction, ambiguity can go either, it can work either for you or against you. A filmmaker might not know what they're doing, so they'll make it deliberately vague, but you don't get that impression with Moon. You really get the sense that the filmmaker knows exactly what the message is that he's delivering kind of below the surface. And it is the kind of movie
of all the other space films that I should revisit, like Bowie's in the Man Who Fell to Earth, right?
Oh, I love The Man Who Fell to Earth. Yeah, Nicholas Rogue. That's a movie that's crazy ambiguous, but it's a lot of fun for that reason. Yeah.
So maybe we should visit that as a theme, the spacey films.
Well, they lend themselves very easily to concerns of isolation and alienation and for that matter, metaphysics and, you know, so.
Well, yeah.
That's my big pick for the week.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a good one. That's one I'd never.
And,
Yeah.
And it's on Netflix, just for people, in case anybody needs to know. It is the kind of movie you need to watch twice. I would recommend that. As if people have any free time these days.
So I actually haven't watched a lot of Netflix this week. I've got some really good, I think they're really good detective series that I enjoy. Vera, Scott and Bailey, and of course Shetland has been rerun as well, which is superb, set on the Shetland Islands. But my latest love is an Italian detective series called Thou Shalt Not Kill, with a young woman detective, very unlike any detective I've ever seen before. And it's subtitled, of course, but it's very refreshing because it's shot in a very Italian way. And there's a lot of swearing that isn't directly translated, but it's good. And she's also having an affair with her boss, so that makes it even more, I wouldn't say creepy, but you know, that weaves into the fabric of the plot, you know, from time to time as well. Mm-hmm. And the one you must catch, it's not a detective series, it's a drama series that has been out for about like 3 weeks now, is World on Fire, which is a big budget, epic World War II series, British series, but it's got Helen Hunt in it, who I love Helen Hunt. And she's playing an American journalist in Berlin during the Polish invasion. And so you see the kind of role of a journalist being intruded upon by first censorship and then not being able to report the horror, the calamities of what she's witnessing. Mm-hmm. And it's very fast moving. It's shot in different countries. It involves not the typical fare for Second World War. It's got interracial love affairs. It's got homosexuality. It's got class differences clashing. So it's got some atypical themes, but it's really well written. And I think you should check it out. Just when you think you've seen everything there is to see about the Second World War, you see, you know, another aspect to it. Particularly the British, there's two different British families that are centered upon. One is very rich and entitled, and the son doesn't get on with the mother and actually ends up going to war to get away from her. But he has a love affair with a girl in Poland who ends up joining the Polish resistance. So there's that theme. And then there's this working class family, the daughter of whom is an entertainer, and she goes around entertaining the troops. And she has a love affair with the boy from the very polished aristocratic background. But her father is a peace activist. So he's always banging on about, well, every war's worthwhile, every war's the right war, and it's a just war till you're in it. And you see this, he's been to the trenches in the First World War, and he's coming back with all that stuff. So it's actually very interesting clash of thinking that was going on at the time, after the disillusionment of the First World War, how people like the soldier, who's the father, doesn't want his kids to have anything to do with the war. So it's well written. It's worth it.
Well, I think it's the excavation potential for World War II seems to be endless.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're still doing it with the Civil War, so we got a long way to go. But yeah.
And so now we're going to finish very briefly on the Tiger King saga, Mike.
Which yeah, I mean,
written off and has rediscovered.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I know I talked about the first couple of episodes the last time we chatted a couple weeks ago, and I imagine probably everyone has seen the series by now, so I don't need to torment you with a summary, except to say that I think episode 3 is the best, which focuses on Carol Baskin, the woman who is portrayed as Joe Exotic's enemy number one, allegedly. That's the most fascinating episode, even though it seems in some ways tangential to what the show is ultimately about, which is the rise and fall of Joe Exotic, this kind of, let's say, low quality zoo owner, right? But the series is definitely good. I mean, he ran for governor, that falls apart, and he brings in these kind of mafioso types into the zoo who take over and basically drive him out. And as everyone probably knows by now, Joe Exotic is in jail. I won't spoil that too much, but I think at least for some of the reasons why he's behind bars, they are justified, whether or not the documentary effectively makes that case. There is one follow-up episode, which I should probably mention is the most significant one, which is called The Tiger King and I. They just released an 8th episode this past week. So Tiger King and I is hosted by the unfortunately quite unfunny Joel McHale. And what it does is basically provide you a where are they now summary of the major players in the documentary. And the documentary in some ways, without the gloss of the show, without that kind of manipulation that I mentioned when we spoke about this previously, you really get a clearer sense that Joe Exotic belongs where he is. And I would say, if you want to try to like attach some meat to the bone of the otherwise sensational documentary, it does focus a couple of things. Animal exploitation, which is an extreme environmental issue that we're not dealing with. That's terribly important. And secondly, the series, I think overall, and I keep racking my brain, why is this the one thing that's been so explosively popular this past month? I think in large part is because it is a study in at least what I would recognize as malignant narcissism. And it shows how much a kind of stupid, no talent blowhard can get away with, right? If you give them an even modicum amount of power. So, I mean, that has to be, you know, the reason why people are watching it. I can't honestly justify it otherwise. As much as I enjoy it, as much as I like the kind of sordid melodrama of the series, you know, my attitude is always, okay, but what is this show's or this movie's for that matter? What is its placement in history? How does it speak to us? How does it operate as a kind of a means of communication for us as a society? And how does it reflect where we are in this day and age? And I think the show confronts a lot of issues that, you know, we are struggling with our own leadership. If I say any more than that, I'll be, you know,
well, you could say this
again, being strident.
Common theme of lockdown, you know, the animals lockdown, we're in lockdown.
Yeah. And two, you know, and I will just say, cause I've been listening to a lot of, you know, a lot of podcasts now, and somebody, this point was recently made that I thought was an excellent summation of what's happening to us. Is that in some ways we are, as a society, being exploited. I'm not going to politicize too much, but there is this sense of, you know, we had to abandon our jobs, not by choice. We are forced into a kind of containment situation. I'm not going to say prison, that's ludicrous, but, you know, we are all effectively and voluntarily contained, you know, and we're not really being taken care of. Like, you know, our needs are not being met in the current state that we're in. I hope a week or a month or a couple months from now, things will improve. But right now, we really do, that sense of feeling caged by the incompetent powers that be, I think, in some respect, speaks to where we are.
Wow, you opened the cauldron there, Mike.
Yeah, should we just end it?
Not being met, I mean.
You'll never see me, if you never see me again, you'll know somebody got to me. Right. So that's my 2-cent conspiracy for the week.
Okay, so, well, I hope we've given you some food for thought and stuff to watch and think about and enjoy even. So I would say it's goodbye from me, Mary Stack.
And goodbye from me, Michael Dow.
See you soon.
Take care.